Hello, folks. Very good to see you all here. When I was thinking about this event today, life takes us back to places and asks us to remember and recall previous events. And at the last Fula event that I was involved in this building in 2010, Martin McGuinness was sitting to my right, and William Plum Smith, who chaired the 1994 Loyalist ceasefire, was sitting to my left. Last summer, Harold and I travelled together to William Smith's funeral, sat together in the church on the Shankill. And just a couple of months ago, I listened outside the church in Derry while Harold and Bill Clinton spoke at the funeral of Martin McGuinness. In that event in 2010 here, with William and with Martin McGuinness, we were speaking about the events of 1993 and 1994, the secret contacts between the British government and the IRA leadership, and the Loyalist and Republican build-up to the ceasefires the following year. And in that conversation, we were speaking about Brendan Duddy, one of the back-channel contacts between the British government and the IRA leadership. Brendan also no longer with us. Harold was sitting in the front row that day alongside Harry Thompson, a veteran Republican, who after the event that day, the Loyalist Jackie MacDonald gave a lift to a medical appointment in the city hospital. Jeanette Irvine, David Irvine's widow, was in the audience that day. And the point of all of that is that we're losing the living memory of the peace process. We're losing those who were key to the events of 1993 and 1994 and beyond. And as we wait for the past to be addressed, we're losing all of those personal accounts, personal record, that individual testimony from so many people. When Harold and I were sitting at that funeral of William Smith on the Shankill Road, you'll remember Harold, his young nephew, singing the song, "Where Have All the Flowers Gone?" And with us today is Mandy, who is William Smith's niece, who spoke at that funeral that day. And as we left the service that day, we left to the anthem of "Give Peace a Chance." And I think the political crisis and dilemma that we're in today is because we took that peace for granted. And there is a rebuilding job to be done. As for this man, Harold Good, I met him 5 years before that Fula event in 2010. I was working for the BBC at that time. And Harold, alongside Father Alec Reed, someone else who is no longer with us, were the church witnesses to IRA decommissioning. And I remember calling Harold, and I said I'd like to come to see you. I was finishing a book, and I travelled to see him. He lives, I didn't know this at the time, but a little over a stone's throw, depending on how strong your arm is.
Don't try it.
Depending on how strong your arm is. But he lives just down the road from me. And I went to his house thinking, this man will colour in all the background detail of decommissioning for me. And what I learned that day and what I've learned in numerous conversations since is that he does not allow the crayons to stray outside the lines of confidentiality. And I think that's been his trademark and his quality within this process, that he has built such trust with so many people. He knows when to be discreet and to be extra careful when he's in the company of journalists. And he has sought no bow.
Can I go now?
And he has sought no bow on the peace process stage. He has been one of our very quiet and important peacemakers. So we meet regularly now. We have coffee. And when I'm when I'm at home and I'm not behaving myself, my wife would say to me, "Have you been to Harold for your supervision?" So he fulfills many roles. But I just when I was looking at that period of 2005 and that decommissioning period, I found a statement from the former Presbyterian moderator Ken Newell, where he described both yourself and Alex Reed as seasoned campaigners for non-violent politics. But he also said at that time, when the church witnesses were asked to fulfill that role in the decommissioning process, better talking eyes than silent photographs. And so I'm going to talk Harold through his life and times. And I'm going to start with a question about your dad, R.J. Good, who went looking for the IRA in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And maybe a bit like father, like son. Mm-hmm. I wonder, is that where it all began in terms of your involvement and your commitment to this process?
Well, thank you, Barney. As you were listing all those who have been no longer, I was getting a bit anxious, like reading down the obituaries in the paper, hoping you're not going to see your own name there. And having just passed yet another big birthday, they seem to come with rapidly every 10 years now.
I didn't realise until recently that you were born on the same day as Robin Eames, isn't that right?
That's right, we're twins, yeah.
One of you's worked out okay?
Yeah, I'm getting a signal.
What happened to you?
I'm getting a signal there to talk loudly.
All right. Yes.
Sorry, what happened to
I was saying that one of you's worked out okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, and I was wondering what happened to you.
I'll leave it to history, yeah. I'll leave it to history to judge.
Yeah. But talk to us about your dad.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think family history is interesting for all sorts of reasons, not least, you know, you see this program, Who Do You Think You Are? And it's interesting, Gareth Malone was on recently, and he discovered he had, about three generations back, he had a musician, and he thought something had must have come down through the genes. Actually, I'm talking about my father at the moment, but my grandfather from Skibbereen in County Cork was in the old RIC. But he left it as a very young man because he refused to take part in the evictions of the late 19th century. And he had 10 children to feed, my father being one of them. And he never really had a decent job after that. But I'd never met him because he died before I was born, but I've had a great respect for him because he was a man, obviously, of great principle. My father was also a Methodist minister, and back in the late 50s he was the president of the Methodist Church, and that, you remember, was, those of you who are old enough to remember, was the time when the border campaign was beginning to come to the fore. And my father, he was in Fermanagh at that time, and there was a young man in his congregation, a young policeman who was shot in Rosslea. I think probably the first young policeman in this sort of period of time to have died. My father was greatly distressed by this. And he wrote a letter to the then Archbishop of the Church of Ireland, to the then Cardinal of the Catholic Church, and to the then moderator. And he said, "We have been charged with the responsibility of leading our respective flocks in the churches. And we have never really sat down to talk. We may have met each other accidentally at some public function, but I think it's time we sat down together to talk about what's happening in our country and what is our responsibility as church leaders in this situation." I have two of the three letters that he got back in reply, and each of those letters is saying in its own way Nice idea, Mr. President, but the time is not right. That's back in the late 50s. Mm. The time is not right. Then, and I've come across the records of the reporting of it, my father decided to make a solo run. And he went to meet what was called the Republican, whatever the title was, in Dublin, and had a long heart-to-heart conversation. I'm not quite sure, but I suspect the name of the person with whom he spoke, significant figure in Republicanism. And he came back and he reported to the Conference of the Methodist Church, interestingly enough, meeting in Putterdown, which is not exactly where you expect the revolution to begin. And he was very open about his conversation. And he ends up by saying he was treated with great respect. He goes on to say that they discussed the vision of a united Ireland. And I think as a Cork man, that wouldn't have been wouldn't have been a big problem for him. But he went on to say, unless this takes place through a proper democratic process, if you try to achieve this through violence, there will be moral as well as political issues to be resolved. And that was the way back in the late 50s. And he left saying it was a very frank, open and sincere conversation both ways. And I thought of all of that when I was asked to be involved in the decommissioning. Mm. And I thought, gosh, all those years later, and so that was from some of my whatever may have come from.
I'll try to get you to colour in a little bit more of the decommissioning. Yeah. A little bit later. But let's talk a little bit about your ministry of the 60s. You were in the States, and then you come back from the States to be on the Shankill Road.
Yeah.
But talk a little bit about the States and how it shaped you and its influence on you. And then we'll talk a little bit about the Shankill Road in that period.
And can I just also give a little snapshot of the sort of late 50s? I was a student minister in South Armagh in Bessbrook. And again, this was sort of during that period of time, and there were some very, very tragic things happening around that area, not on the scale of more recent times, but they were there. And there was a curfew introduced. And there was huge reaction to this curfew from the nationalist people. And I had a pass that I was given for the purpose of attending to my duties. So I could be out after 10, but everybody else was supposed to be in after it. And I was coming home one evening on my little scooter from a country appointment, and I heard huge noise and disturbance in Market Square in Uri. And I couldn't resist. As a young fella, parked my scooter, and I walked down the street into Market Square and looked around the corner what was happening. There was a protest against the curfew, and the RUC had been commissioned to bring water cannon in to hose the people out of the square. Now, I was politically, in other ways, very naive, and not, young fellows like myself weren't taking a lot of interest in politics, but I can remember that moment saying, whatever this is about, this is pouring petrol on this fire. And I knew that, and people were saying the next day, oh, well, that'll sort them all out. I said, no. That was one of my early sort of forcing me to think about where we are and where we live and the
country. To think in a way that others weren't thinking at that time?
Probably, yeah. Anyhow.
60s.
The years roll by, and I go to America for a period of study to broaden my experience. I've lived in this small island, and there's a world out there I need to explore, church-wise as well as in other ways. And this is mid-60s. So they're everywhere in mid-America, mid-60s. And that was the civil rights campaign was very much me, Selma and all of that. And I found myself, the senior pastor of my church took me on marches. And then I found myself in Indianapolis. And I was asked if I would just look after on a part-time basis an inner city church along with my studies. So I went down to this inner city church, and it was an entirely black congregation, except for one white lady who refused to leave when all the other whites left. She said, "No, I'm not. I'm staying here." And she was sitting there like the Queen Mother, treated by everybody as royalty. And they were amazing people. And this was my first real experience of black America, mid-60s, with all that was going on at that time. And then Martin Luther King was assassinated. And there I was with these people. And I said, "You'll need somebody who can understand your community perhaps better than I to take the service next Sunday morning." And they said, "No, you're our pastor. You care for us." And I discovered the meaning of grace from those people. They taught me what grace really is all about. I had studied in textbooks, I'd heard people lecture on it, but I'll tell you, those people helped me to understand it. Then Bobby Kennedy, he was assassinated shortly afterwards. And again, this community of people, they were in grief. It wasn't just a loss of an individual or individuals. It was the death of their dreams and their hopes and everything that they had hoped for. And so I went through that. There were other experiences during that time in America. I'll not go into the detail, but in Kentucky, where I saw naked racism. And I began to hear people talk in a way, and I thought, where have I heard that kind of language before? And I began to realize that racism and sectarianism are interchangeable words, and two sides of the coin, whatever image you want to use. But I thought, I've heard this language. And so anyhow, time came to return home, and my wife and I were, we'd been between study and work and bringing two little girls into the world. We were we needed summer quiet for a while.
You took the shankle, did you?
Well, we want summer quiet. So I said, I knew there was a Methodist church in the Midlands of Ireland that was going to be in need of a minister. And I went down to Tipperary, and I sent word back, nobody else wants to go there. I'll be delighted to go there. I discovered that somebody else must have wanted to go there, because the word came back. In those days, it was letters you passed.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
A letter came back saying, "You're going to be the minister of Agnes Street Methodist Church in the middle of the Shankill Road, 1968. So quiet, time to refresh and renew your batteries, and have time to catch up in the Shankill Road in 1968. It wasn't really what you would have thought of as the answer to that request. So we arrived and found ourselves there in an incredible, 68 was just, things were just beginning to hot up. And so the next few years, it was deeply immersed in what was happening. the tragedies, the fears, the hurts, and began to try, then realizing we've got to find a way of, that was my sort of, how do we, you know, do we just, are we just first aid people here? Is this all we're doing? If that's all we're doing, okay, it's important. First aid is very important. The paramedics are great people and we need them. But we began to realize, no, we need something more. And so we began to try and build some kind of communication between the Shankill and the Falls. Padraig Murphy was the larger than life in every sense in St. Peter's and St. Paul's. And he and I said, well, let's see if we could spin a thread which might one day become a piece of string. And that might one day become a rope. And you never know, we might even be able to build a bridge between the two communities. And that's...
That was the beginning of that.
That was the beginning of that. And took us into another route. Father Des Wilson became a part of that. And it's another story.
You talked about the fear.
Yeah.
In that period. And I think... Even I'm a bit young to remember it in great detail, but
I've got hair.
Yeah, I know. I've got worry, but what was your principal fear at that stage? Was it that things were just going out of control, that it wasn't going to be possible to pull it back, or did you see some hope within that fear, however bad it was?
I think we were all naive enough to think, you know, give it 3 or 4 years at the most, and that seemed to be very bleak. People said, oh, no, come on, we can't keep. But that's what the way our mind was thinking, you know, maybe at the worst 5 years. But, you know, like the end of the 50s, the border campaign, you know, it went away for a while, and people thought, this is good. And then as time went on, we realized, no, this is deeper, 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 deeper. And politically, things were going worse. And we began to realize the reality is, and it's going to, first aid isn't enough. Just reacting. Sorry, I'm getting more signals. Can anybody in the back hear me? If you can't hear me, will you raise your hand and wave or something? Okay.
But you did witness tremendous acts of generosity in that dark period. Just talk to us a little bit about some of those.
There were tremendous acts of brutality. I can remember 3 young men dying in our church hall on a Saturday night. They were loyalists, and they'd got caught up in this, and they'd been shot by the British Army. And I remember we had to literally, and I'm sorry for the name, but we literally had to mop the blood from the floors of our Sunday school room before we could let the children in on the next day. The Balmoral Furniture Shop bomb. I was conducting a wedding on the Saturday afternoon, and I remember very clearly we were just signing the register when it felt like the building had lifted, and it was a bomb placed in the Balmoral Furniture Shop. And as soon as I had closed the register and said goodbye to the bride and groom, I went down and joined with the men who had all rushed from wherever, and we were digging through this with our hands. And I can remember the body of a child being lifted out of this rubble and having to go to the hospital and minister to the mother of that child. So there were those ghastly, ghastly, ghastly things.
But you also saw neighbours respond to
absolutely.
Other neighbours being forced from their homes at that
people
time.
People were being forced from their homes. And from the Hooker Street side of Crumlin Road over to the sort of Raleigh Street side of the Shankill Road, or of the Crumlin Road, that interface, which was a very, very contested interface just below Holy Cross. And I can remember Protestant families saying to their Catholic neighbours, leave the children with us. If you don't feel safe staying here tonight, we look after your children. We've lived together and our kids have grown together. Come on, we look after them. They'll be all right. And I discovered the same thing was happening over on the Catholic side of the Crumlin Road. People were telling me the same stories. And there were people who came into these communities from both sides of this conflict, driving people out. Yet within all of that, there was this goodness that people were desperately trying to. I can remember, I think I told you the story recently of an old couple who lived just on the street, Richmond Street, just beside my church. And he was Catholic, she was the Catholic, and he was not. But he was blind. And they had two grandchildren living with them, whose mother had been deemed unable to look after her children. So they were living with Granny and Granddad. And one afternoon, the neighbours came running down to the little church office we had, and they said, come quick, they're putting out the Hannahs. And I went out, and there was this old couple with all their furniture and their meagre belongings out on the street. And the neighbours were furious. The neighbours were in agony, but they felt helpless to do anything about it. And we gathered them up with their belongings. The old man had a budgie that was his companion, and they'd let it go and opened the cage, and that was very hurtful to him. Anyway, in they came, and we looked after them for 2 or 3 days in the church hall until they were rehoused.
Almost like a dormitory, was it?
Oh, the church hall had become like a dormitory. And again, huge generosity from the people. Anyway, the years rolled by, and just a few months ago, I got a phone call. This young man called Tony Hanna would like to see me. Tony was one of the two children. And after all these years, he said, I just wanted to thank you, after all these years. And that's how many years ago. And, there were huge human stories in all of that conflict. But I remember the weekend of Bombay Street was burned. And I went up on the next day to the school somewhere up there where the families were sheltering. And Joe Camlinson, I don't know whether that name means anything to some of you, Joe Camlinson was kind of in charge of operations. And I said, is there anything you need? And he gave me a list of things. Mm. I went into my Methodist church on the Shankill Road on a Sunday morning. And I said, I've been up to the school to meet these families, to bring our sympathy to them. And I said, I have a list of things that they desperately need, lots of them to do with children, children's things, toiletries and clothing and whatever. And I said, if anybody would like to bring something, I'll be going up there tomorrow and I will bring them up as a gift from our congregation. Well, going out from church that morning, there were people saying, we can't think of what I could give you, but maybe that would help. And they put money in my hand. And it was something like £74.10, which in those days was quite a lot of money from a Protestant church in the Shankill where people didn't have a lot of money. And the next day I went up with a carload of stuff and this money to bring. And so, you have this image of hatred and bitterness and disaster and tragedy and, whatever. And here in the midst of it is this sort of like a candle lit somewhere in the middle of it all. And those are the sort of, this is where I came to cherish and value those people who are so readily dismissed on both sides by people who just do not understand the sense of community and the identity that people had, because everybody was suffering and everybody was saying, gosh, imagine losing your home.
You mentioned that young lad, Hannah. He gave you something. just recently when you met him.
He did.
You showed me it last week.
I did. When I went to see him, he, I had said, I'm going to take you out for lunch. And he said,